All right. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is a Tuesday edition of the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're going to stay in the newsroom for just a sec because Kim had that late addition to the EPA. Now, the president earlier today signed executive action that reinvigorates the Dakota pipeline and the XL pipeline, right? And so I don't know if that's part of this, but what is this going on at the EPA?
Let me get to that. I'll get to that in one second, but we also have some breaking news. We're getting calls and texts from listeners saying that there's something going on in Bartlett. We have not been able to confirm exactly what that is at this point. We're waiting for a phone call from police, but we do know that several schools also in the area are on lockdown. So we will let people know as soon as we know what's going on there. So now back to the EPA. The AP just issued this urgent saying that anyone working at the EPA has been there's been a media blackout and staff is also barred from awarding any new contracts or grants.
Okay, I get the contracts or the grants.
Okay, and then it says emails sent to the EPA since Trump's inauguration on Friday and reviewed by the AP detailed the specific prohibitions banning releases, blog updates, or posts to the agency's social media accounts.
Okay, well, we'll follow that.
So we will, and there's also been a temporary suspension of all new business activities.
Sure.
So we'll,
and which makes some sense. I mean, they're coming in, and clearly they're going to go in a different direction.
Right.
So you don't want to continue anything that's going in what they think might be the wrong direction.
Right. So we'll
We'll wait for the Facebook post, maybe. I don't know. All right, Kim Gordon in the newsroom on that. Thanks very much. As I said earlier, we'll talk with Andrew Herman about records in Wicker Park in just a few minutes, and Suzanne Mushin as well in the second half hour. Right now, it's time to say hello to Dennis Rodkin. He writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business and joins us from time to time. Dennis, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. Okay, so I saw when I got in this morning and press release from the Illinois Realtors, I think, about home sales, and they right. were down to end the year, but up for the year, right? Is that what I was reading?
Yeah, the monthly figures for December were below, for December 2016, were below December 2015, but overall for the year, 2016 ended better than 2015. Both prices and the number of homes were up for the city and for the nine-county metro area.
High enough to cheer about?
Well, geez, given the couple of years we had in the past, yes. Not up like Seattle, like Portland, but yeah, we pretty healthy. Sales in the region were up about 4% for the year, and in the city they were up just under 2% for the year over 2015.
I know you've got this really cool, I was looking and playing with this interactive model at yeah. Cranes right now about where specifically homes went up and where they didn't and by how much you can click on each town. And you tell me, but it looks, if you look at the map broadly, it looks like the suburbs to the southwest and the suburbs along the lakefront far to the north, like Waukegan or so, were the big winners last year. Am I looking at that correctly?
Well, yeah, but you need to.
You could say no. It sounds like the answer is no.
Well, you are reading the map correctly. It's just that you need one more piece of information, which we have in the story, which is that in many. So this is a measure of how the median home price changed in 2016 from 2015, and in a lot of those places you mentioned, Waukegan, a lot of far south suburbs, a lot of south side city neighborhoods. What actually happened is the high volume of sales of low-priced foreclosures is kind of going away. So that rock bottom figure is moving off the board. The majority of sales are market priced, which are higher than the foreclosure prices. So it looks like the median price has jumped way up. And in fact, it has. But it's because of a shift of types of sales rather than we wouldn't want to mislead anybody to think there's been some frenzy of interest in Waukegan. Not that Waukegan is a bad place to live. We just don't want people to think, oh my gosh, I got to run up there and invest. It's actually just that there's been a shift from heavy foreclosures. We're coming out of that phase, finally, where most of the purchases were foreclosures to market-priced sales.
Okay, so then where would we look to see where the biggest gains were last year?
Well, when you essentially, if you look at the ones, when you scroll down to the city especially, when you look at the ones where prices were up 10, 15%, places like Bridgeport, they were up 14%, those kinds of things. That's a more realistic figure that simply shows a lot more activity, a lot of interest in buying. Jefferson Park, prices were up 9%. Lincoln Square, prices were up 10%. Those are the more reasonable figures. The ones you were looking at where they're up over 30 and 40%, I just wanted to be sure nobody thought, wow, you know, there's something volcanic happening there.
Right.
But there are a lot of places. The other thing you see from this map, so you saw the bright blue, but the other thing you might want to pay attention to is there's a lot more red there than you might think.
I only look at the good news, Dennis. I only look at the good news.
Well, unfortunately, I have to look at all the news. And there is quite a belt of red, which is where prices either were flat or, I'm sorry, they're not red if they were flat. They're just down a little bit to a lot. And you see places like Libertyville, Lake Forest, Lake Zurich, in the north part of the suburbs, and you see Westmont and others, Frankfurt, in the south and west parts of the suburbs, where prices actually were lower by the end of 2016 than they were at the end of 2015.
Do they share anything? Is there a reason? Is there a reason why that might be happening?
Well, part of it is some of those are not big drops, but part of it is a change in Lake Forest. It is very true that homes are selling very slowly. They're selling at big discounts. From you and I have talked on the air about how a lot of the houses on the North Shore are selling below their 2006 prices, and in many cases below 2002, 2003. Many of them were over-improved, overdeveloped to the point that people really just don't want to spend what you have in your house. But it's also the primary thing our entire region has in common is we're still coming out of that crisis. I mean, it's been 10 years,
right,
but we are still moving out. So it's not that there's a black mark against any of these red places. It's just that prices haven't yet been consistently going up.
All right, 30 seconds or so. Is there an area where we should be buying this year because you're expecting good things next year?
Yes, that's the other story I have out. I looked at places where prices consistently rose throughout the year and then also looked at schools and commuting and a whole bunch of other features. And in Chicago, we found, for example, we have 18 on the list, and you don't have time for that. But in Chicago, it's places like Hyde Park, Forest Glen, Garfield Ridge, Uptown. In the suburbs, Hinsdale, Elmhurst, Oak Park, Riverside, Buffalo Grove. A lot of places where improvement in prices has been pretty consistent. But again, they also have really good commute times, easy commute. That's by car or by mass transit. We looked at both. Good schools. And several other amenities went in. And so what we were looking for is these are the places where you really can invest now and feel that the past is behind that crisis, that 10 years I was talking about. You can feel that that's in the rearview mirror. Buy here and feel that it's a nice, solid investment going forward.
It's kind of fun. Go to chicagobusiness.com. You can check that out and scroll around to your in-law suburbs and see how much money they lost on their house last year. Dennis,
perspective to thanks,
it's always great to talk to you. Thanks very much. 1223, this is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here. Thanks very much for tuning in. Hope you'll follow me on Twitter at Steve Bertrand or on my Steve Bertrand Facebook page. Andrew Herman is in the studio from DNA Info Chicago. It comes by from time to time. Call it openings and closings, things that are opening up. And, well, you know, we went through about two decades of closings when it comes to record stores.
Yeah.
And now the stories about record stores is that they're opening again.
Yeah, now you can't keep them down. There's a new one opening in Wicker Park, the Purple Llama Coffee and Records. And the Coffee and Records tells something because it's primarily a coffee shop that also sells records, whereas some of these other record stores that we've seen pop up on the north side are mostly about records, but they also have coffee. But
okay.
These guys are really about coffee and records as sort of a sideline.
I want to have these guys on when they open maybe because it's pretty fascinating. First of all, Purple Llama. Llama refers to a Neil Young song?
Well, it refers to a couple of different bands that use the word purple, and I have to say, and I like to think of myself as a music aficionado. I did not know any of them, though. In looking up the Led Zeppelin one, I did see where that comes from. You know, there's a song, "Livin' Lovin'," She's just a woman. Well, she's carrying a purple umbrella.
I don't get it.
Umbrella.
Can you sing it for me? How does it go?
No, I cannot.
Well,
I cannot.
Here's what I like about, or what fascinates me about this store is because, really, Andrew, I'm reading the story and I'm thinking, I've got like 3 crates of albums in my basement that I keep thinking I'm going to record or do something. I should just take them to a store like this and sell them for, you know, whatever. They don't want my old records. This is a record store that sells new records.
Right, right. And so, and that's sort of the hip thing now is that bands will put out albums and actually make vinyl records. And so for their true fans and people who like records, I never quite understood why people love them so much. But I mean, I like buying them. I like going to record stores. But the actual scratching and popping of records, I don't get it.
I like to smell them.
Yes. Well, it also comes with all the cool art and everything. But I was looking at the year in record sales this week out of Nielsen, and vinyl went up 10%, but CDs were down 16%, and digital was down 20%.
So the hot, now, okay, vinyl went up, but that doesn't mean it's a majority.
Still small.
Okay, right.
Yeah, so what people are doing now is streaming, and so you basically just pay a certain amount of money to a site like Spotify for a month, and then you just listen to whatever album you want for the entire month, and I've sort of moved on to that.
I have too, and I've given up a lot of choices. I don't have the subscription yet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Pandora guy, so
yeah.
Introduced to new songs that, you know, that I haven't heard in a while.
That is one of the good things that it does is they tell you if you like this, then you might like this, and all of a sudden your musical horizons are expanding.
The downside is there was a real wonder in listening to an LP and knowing the song that was coming. You know, you'd hear the next song and boom, you'd get into it and you knew the stories of it. That's just gone.
They don't play them in order if you're not paying.
No. All right, so go to the Purple Llama, have a cup of coffee, but don't stay too long. They want you to check out the records, buy some if you want, and talk to the people next to you, then move on.
Yeah.
What's this job sharing space now in Logan Square that's opening?
This is called Second Shift. It's at 3432 West Diversity, also opening in February, and it's a remote working space for all those people who work from home but don't really want to work from home.
Right, they want to get out of the house.
Right, so it's it kind of gives you sort of a traditional place to work. It's $145 a month. You get an open desk, 3 1/4 for a designated desk. And again, this is another growing field. I was looking at some federal labor statistics, and they say that 24% of American workers now say that they do some or all of their work from home.
Right. And so, you know, for me, I'd be like, oh, that's a dream come true. I never have to leave the house. But I know there are a lot of people who just feel terrible in their house, so they're willing to pay money to go out and sit by other people they don't have to.
I completely understand. I am part of the 24% who occasionally works from home, and I never like it.
Drives you crazy.
It's not a newsroom.
No, it's not. It's good that it's not.
Well, you can only tell yourself so many jokes, right?
Yeah. Andrew Herman from DNA Info. The thing is, you laugh at all of them if you tell them yourself.
Yeah.
I'm glad you came into this office today.
Okay.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, a Tuesday afternoon. Coming up later in the program, we are going to go to Utah. When's the last time you were in Utah? Connor Boyack is the president of Libertas University. It's a libertarian sort of group. And then he writes, well, he's written a lot of books, but he's lately written, I guess, libertarian kids books. And the idea is all about citizenship and fostering citizenship, kind of a theme today. I think we're going to talk tomorrow to a U.S. magistrate about engaging people in the... Is that tomorrow or next week, Bennett? Bennett's looking up. Anyway,
Steve,
soon.
Can I clarify something while Bennett's looking up?
I try to clarify something, sure.
Okay, so we've been talking about that situation in Bartlett. We're still not clear as to what's going on, but we do have confirmation now. Sycamore Hills Elementary School is in secure building mode, which means nobody is allowed in and out. School is going on as normal. There is no threat to the school, so we just wanted to clarify exactly what was going on at that school. We'll keep you posted when we find out what's going on in Bartlett.
That's certainly more important than my clarification, but my point is that we're going to talk to a U.S. magistrate, to their federal judges and federal lawyers who have this concerted effort to get out into the schools and teach citizenship. So we'll talk about that tomorrow with the federal judge. We'll talk about it today with Connor Boyack. But first, it's Tuesday. This is when Suzanne Mushin, the co-host of The Big Payoff, is usually in the studio. That's a podcast you can hear at WGMplus.com. Sadly, she went to the march on Saturday and is still lost somewhere in Grand Park.
That wouldn't have been so bad. It was 60 and sunny. I could have easily spent a good amount of time there.
So we had one of the organizers on Friday, and she said then they upped it from 50,000 to 65,000. And I said at the time, I said, are you worried? Because it's easy to sign up and harder to go. Are you worried that you might have a disappointing crowd? And she said, not with the forecast. Wow. What, you know, and you and I have been talking about this for a long time, and I have been under expecting for an even longer time. What an event.
It was an incredible event. You know, as I walked up to Grant Park, you know, I'm a marathon runner, so I'm used to walking into a crowd there. And marathons in Chicago, what, 40,000, something like that? And as we approach, I remember turning to my friend and saying, this is a whole heck of a lot more than 40,000.
Yeah.
And it was just, the turnout was unbelievable. All ages, men and women, very diverse, very empowering.
It struck me as, I mean, clearly they were reacting to something. They were brought out to be against, but it seemed to me like a joyful against or a joyful protest almost.
It's interesting to frame it that way, Steve. Yes, I think that it's the mobilizing fact was to be against. In particular, you saw with all the hats that we gave you a nicer name to use on the air.
Yes, those hats were awesome.
The hats were awesome. Those were clearly in response to now President Trump's comments about women. But I would say there was a lot of for out there rather than against. People were trying to stand up for the rights of immigrants and LGBT, and they were trying to stand up for more women in positions of leadership. So although I agree the triggering event was an anti, the rally felt very for. And I think, correct me if you heard otherwise, I believe that there were zero violent incidents, at least not here in Chicago.
I'm not aware of any. And so then, you know, and I was guilty of this as well. The next question is, well, what do you do with that? And
yeah.
I think that's a good question. But I also think sometimes we're so concerned about leveraging something that we don't just pause to enjoy the moment of it.
Good point. And
I think there really should be a great just celebration. It reminded me of the immigration rallies in Chicago, 10 years or so ago, when there were, you know, not that many people, but many people coming in with a really affirmative sort of position. And that's the way Saturday struck me anyway. So
it was also, I think, a celebration of citizenship. You know, this is what a democracy looks like and feels like. And I think for a lot of people out there, just that recognition that in spite of all the things we might be unhappy about, we do live in a country where this is possible was very, very evident.
Okay, having said that, how do you make anything out of it?
Good. Well, it's interesting because they are, in fact, trying to organize another rally in D.C., but with corresponding rallies around the country on April 15th in response to Kellyanne Conway coming out this week and saying, in fact, Trump will not be releasing his taxes. And again, here's our democracy in action, Steve. When a petition gathers more than 100,000 signatures in 30 days, and goes to the White House, they are obligated to respond. This particular petition asking Trump to release his taxes was signed by over 200,000 people in that time period. So her official response was, we will not be releasing his taxes, more or less ever. So the next rally cry to action, people are saying, will occur on tax day on April 15th.
And I think did she amend that to say to put the audit language back in? I don't know, but
not really. I think she said during the campaign we were clear that not until, and then she more or less said, look, now he's in office. Nobody seemed to really care that much because he's president. So onward.
Well, OK, and we'll see. And this is where it gets risky because, you know, the president, if the numbers are down next time, and they will be down, there's no way they will match this one.
Then
you lose your leverage or your momentum a little bit. So it's a tricky sort of spot that the protesters are in.
Yeah, I feel that this may, I don't know that we'll repeat those kind of numbers, but it did feel like a movement was underfoot, not just a one-day event. And what I love also is that Newberry Library in Chicago is collecting the signs and it's going to create a display of them, which I think is fantastic. Because really, the signs were so many different kinds of awesome and creative that I can't say enough about what people did.
I am leery. You know, I try to, obviously there are gender differences, but I sometimes feel like all the good attributes are attributed to women and all the negative are attributed to men, which, you know, it can't be true. But the sign thing was, I don't know if it was a gender thing, but it wasn't just a Chicago thing or a Washington thing. It sort of was a spontaneous thing everywhere. All the marches
everywhere.
Were known for the really cool
signs. The really cool signs.
What's that about?
Well, I think that it gave people an opportunity to, even though there wasn't really an organized, nobody was being asked to, quote, do anything, I think making a sign was a way of expressing yourself. And people just went all out.
They did.
And, you know, a lot of them are not appropriate, shouldn't be appropriate here. But, you know, there were some really good ones. I really loved If Boys Will Be Boys, which was a reference to, you know, Trump's language, you know, locker room talk. So it said, if boys will be boys, then girls will be president. That's empowering, right? Yeah. I mean, there's a little dig there. But
turns out to be
empowering.
Most recently incorrect, but yeah, no, I agree. And
okay,
but so then on the other side of all this is Katie Rich, who's a writer for Saturday Night Live. And
yep.
Katie, I've met Katie. Katie's been in here a few times. She's on with Bill and Wendy. She's from Chicago. And she tweeted out a joke about Barron Trump, who's what, 10 years old?
Yeah.
And he should have done it. It was, you know, you don't do that. And so she's been suspended indefinitely from Saturday Night Live. What do you make of that?
Well, look, and what's interesting is this morning, Second City in Chicago actually came to her defense and was really saying, look, we're comedy writers. This stuff is part of free speech, et cetera. My opinion on it is that's not helpful. I mean, to go after a child, and even I thought it was interesting, Chelsea Clinton came out very publicly and said, this should not be acceptable.
Right. So
and that's the piece of it I agree with. This isn't about him. He's a child. Leave him out of it.
And I was surprised by the suspension being indefinite. We'll see how long that is because that just seemed a little harsh to me, but you don't do it. You just can't. It's not.
No, I think there has to be a line. And that's really the message that I think this suspension gave is that go out and march. You know, wear your pink hats, do all of that. You know, Alec Baldwin can be funny, but there actually is a line.
Suzanne Muschen, the co-host of The Big Payoff. You can listen to that at WGNplus.com and currently wandering around. Can you see the Petrillo band shell? If you see the band shell, face it and then just keep walking. You'll find Michigan Avenue and
I'll be holding. I'll be holding a big sign.
I don't want to read that sign.
Me.
I don't want to read that sign. Thanks very much. We'll
Thanks,
see you again
Steve.
Next week. We're going to go to Utah now. Connor Boyack is the guy behind the Libertas Institute, and he's written some kids' book to that effect. Connor, okay, we have to start with pronunciation help. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Libertas.
So it's actually Latin, and obviously as a dead language, no one quite knows.
No, you know what it is? What it is I'm looking at a pronouncer, so it's supposed to help me, and I think if I just looked at the word, I would have been okay.
It's for those who don't know, our Statue of Liberty is based on the Roman goddess of liberty, who her name is Libertas, and so that's what our institute is named after.
Libertas. And are you limited to Utah, or are you national in spoke?
So our policy work at Libertas Institute is limited to Utah, where we're located. But then our educational programs, such as we're going to talk about, are, of course, generally applicable and you know, for everybody.
Yeah, I'm interested in that. And, you know, we're talking about citizenship a lot lately, given the big marches and the inauguration and all of that. And so I want to get to that. But I first want to start with this libertarian idea, because I wonder if the notion of a libertarian is different in Utah than what it might be in Illinois or New York or Washington. We think of you guys as wide open fighters out there.
Well, you know, for our work, while we're often branded as libertarian, we focus on, if you were to draw a Venn diagram between conservatism and libertarianism, there's like an 85% overlap. And
okay.
So as just one example, our policy work focuses on parental rights and property rights and economic liberty and government transparency. These are things we even find agreement with people on the left on. We try and really find opportunities of common agreement. We're not out there really advocating for, you know, legalizing prostitution or crazy stuff like that. So for us, libertarian is really, let's make sure people can exercise their God-given rights, and that government, if it's going to interfere, only does so when absolutely necessary.
I think some libertarians have said, and I've heard many of them say, that most Americans are libertarian, they just don't realize it.
Well, and the founders themselves, they called it classical liberal, but it was definitely this recognition that, look, we have rights, we create a government to serve and protect us, and that's it. The government should not, you know, nurture and care for us cradle to grave and steal from Peter to pay Paul. We should limit the government to the protection of our rights. That was definitely a founding father classical liberal idea. And in its modern sense, it's very much a libertarian idea.
Okay, so we've got all of that background, and you've certainly written books on economics and all of this, a lot of columns. And then comes along the Tuttle twins. You're writing children's books about this idea of citizenship. Explain that for me.
So this was born out of my own experience. I'm a dad of young kids.
How old?
I wanted to find, they're about, let's see, 7 and 5 right now.
Okay.
And so I wanted to find books that would teach them these ideas of, you know, political science and economics, the free market. What does it mean? What's money? And there was nothing. And so I spent about a week being kind of bummed, you know, and then figured, hey, maybe I can create something. And so really it's a supplement for parents to talk about these ideas with their kids, because even at a young age, 5 to 10, they can really understand and wrap their head around these core ideas.
Okay, Connor, it's shocking to me that your kids, you were looking around for a children's book about free markets and you couldn't find one.
You know, there's stories that you can kind of extrapolate and help make sense to a kid, but there's nothing that just kind of clarifies and explains what it all is. Yeah. And certainly for teenagers and stuff, is, but for that younger age group, there was really nothing.
Yeah, no, I'm giving you a hard time because I can see probably why there wouldn't be a market there, and yet you found that there really is a market there.
It's been explosive, and I appreciate you clarifying, because I lost your sarcasm. I'm glad you explained. Oh, yeah, there's a huge market. And when we craned the first book, it was more of an experiment, but the response was overwhelming. And what we're hearing from our biggest customer is a conservative parent who's concerned that their kids are getting more of kind of this pro-government, pro-central planning indoctrination, for lack of a better word, in schools. And so these parents want to supplement at home. They want to make sure their kids are getting different perspectives. They haven't really wrapped their heads around, as a parent, how to talk about these ideas with their kids. So in come the Tuttle Twins, so that they can kind of help foster those conversations and have a dialogue with their kids.
What about the liberal parents who don't want to see government sort of taken over by religion, or government sort of taken over by social concerns on the right? Do these books, and it's a genuine question, are these books attractive to those concerns as well?
The books, as much as possible, we try not to be theological. They're more just issue-based. So,
right.
For example, one of our books is about money. Why was gold once used as money? Why do things cost more today than they did when, you know, grandpa was our age? And so we try and present issues that, again, aren't really presented in schools. Most parents haven't talked to their kids about it. But in a way, some of the issues can be more conservative, but an issue that of what money is and why things cost more, what inflation is, that's not a conservative idea. That's just the way things are. And it's just a matter of offering children a little bit of background and context to those issues. So, yeah, it is and can be appealing to people who don't even necessarily agree with our core philosophy.
I would imagine that the goal is not that children read these books and become citizens, but that children read these books and there's sort of a platform for them to grow into responsible citizenship.
Yeah, and what does that mean? What is responsible citizenship? If it means to be informed and engaged, then absolutely. And you can't be engaged effectively and appropriately if you're not informed. That even kids at a young age, there's so many cool stories around the nation of little kids, you know, whether it's with a lemonade stand or the one boy who had the little libraries on the, you know, in front yards that the city was banning. It's important that even kids, even younger kids, can get engaged and understand the world that they're growing up into. We want them to be responsible citizens. That requires them to be informed. And so here's a way with the Tuttle Twins books to talk to our kids about these important issues rather than just waiting until they're, oh, hey, you're voting, so let's finally tell you what it means to be a good citizen.
Right, it's time to learn. Connor Boyack, the names of the book series, The Tuttle Twins. Great to talk to you. Thank you very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thank you.